Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midwest Hemp Council Weekly Podcast, brought to you by the Bose Public Affairs Group at Bose, McKinney & Evans. I'm your host, Jason Dozier. Thanks for being with us this week when we will hear from Jeremy Kletke, CEO and founder of Davis Hemp Farms in Bend, Oregon. He's worked overseas in the hemp industry in the early 2000s and has brought his knowledge back to the West Coast after the 2018 Farm Bill legalized hemp in the United States. So let's get started. Jeremy, thanks for being with us this week.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, let's start a little bit with your background. I know back in 2016, you did work with members of the Oregon State Farm Bureau and the Oregon Department of Agriculture to draft the current House bill under which the Oregon Industrial Hemp Program operates. So a big player in hemp in Oregon. Tell us how you got involved in that and what led you up to working with those members there in 2016.
Certainly. So my background just briefly extends almost 30 years in the cannabis and hemp space. I worked in, had the opportunity to work in Switzerland in the late 90s with the Swiss government and the Swiss Medical Hemp Foundation. That was my first experience in producing CBD and THC one-to-ones back when people weren't really paying attention to the different cannabinoids. From there, I was able to work in Holland and spent some time in Czech Republic and back here into Oregon in 2007 when the medical program got moving and due to our awareness of CBD, you know, started creating one-to-ones, two-to-ones, 10-to-1 ratios of CBD to THC plants for the medical market and providing those to patients. Natural evolution as the recreational market took off in 2015. Sort of, you know, the desire for CBD in that marketplace was waning. At the same time, we saw the opportunity of these new hemp programs opening up, particularly in Colorado, and the 2014 hemp bill, you know, giving us an opportunity to create a hemp program in Oregon. And so, as you stated, we went about working with the Oregon State Legislature to get what was called the note from mother to carry our legislative concept to legislative council to draft the hemp bill under which Oregon is operating. In 2016, we had the first opportunity to produce field acres of hemp. It seems kind of small now, but looking back, I mean, it was the biggest crop in the state at the time at 29 acres. And so from there, we just kind of launched into a breeding program, used the progeny that we had discovered and began working with some of it American Pharoah based from pre-1937 to start building our lines. And in 2019, we released the first feminized seed to the marketplace.
Now, you said you got involved overseas back in the early 2000s. What actually took you into the hemp market at that point? Why? What was going on in Switzerland and Holland over there that got you involved in that market? What led you to those organizations?
Certainly. So, you know, anyone who would know, you know, the Netherlands at all in their cannabis background understands that they had a very liberal regulatory structure. They were very open to if you want marijuana, if you will, or high THC cannabis at the time. So it was really the policy that drove me to these places. In 1997, Switzerland ended up legalizing, pretty much blanket legalizing all drugs, moving away from a policy of enforcement into a policy of education and treatment where it was needed. So in 1997, we had the opportunity to enter there. There were obviously people who were interested in the cannabis space, even people that were a little bit more forward thinking than I was at the time. They were looking at it, you know, purely from the medicinal aspect. I didn't really know too much about the plant at that time, but there were some people that were from the States here that I was affiliated with. And they, you know, called upon me to come and help them with some of the aspects of the field scale they were dealing with. It was a couple of hectares at that time, since I had a little bit broader agricultural background than they did growing up in sort of the agricultural world. And so that afforded me the opportunity to you know, go over there in 97 and experience that. We did that for 2 years. And then while we moved on to Holland, unfortunately, there was some pushback from, you know, global policymakers saying that you know, it wasn't time for them to kind of open the doors up. And so that ended up closing that opportunity, but it was a great learning experience. And, you know, certainly was a higher level and a more professional experience, I think, than most of the people in the States were experienced that time that were involved in marijuana.
Well, with over 15, almost 20 years of experience dealing with hemp and THC, certainly glad we have you on the program to pick your brain and talk about these things. But let's bring it back over to the States here. And again, we're speaking with Jeremy Kletke, the CEO and founder of Davis Hemp Farms. Tell us a little bit about Davis Hemp Farms and specifically what you guys do there on the farm.
You bet. So Davis Hemp Farms is a seed breeding and production facility for the hemp space. And what we're specifically focused on are federally compliant hemp varieties that contain reasonable amounts of CBD, as well as terpenes and other minor cannabinoids. So here in Oregon, we've created a pest, pathogen, and virus-free environment from which we work to provide high-quality seed to this new industry across the nation.
Would that be basically a greenhouse effect is what you're talking about, or do you guys grow outside?
So it's a combination of greenhouses and indoor, because we have a pest, pathogen, and virus-free mother stock facility where we can maintain all of our filial 1 or F1 first-generation mother stock, which is what we breed from. And then we move those out into a climate-controlled environment for seed production. In order to do high-quality feminized seed, to create high-quality feminized seed, you need quite a controlled environment. You can't have really any variability.
And Jeremy, again, being in Oregon, I'm not familiar with the terrain there, with the weather, that sort of thing. You've been a world traveler. Certainly, you've been to the Midwest. How does the growing conditions in Oregon differ, or are they the same as the Midwest?
So Oregon obviously has a diverse set of bioregions and microclimates. You know, we have coastal ranges that are quite humid and, you know, filled with rain, and then we have high desert as well. So we have quite a broad spectrum. But from a breeding standpoint, the reason that we have, and to touch on, you know, the value of the genetics that we have or creating genetics in Oregon that can be used in the Midwest. So what we've done specifically is we've created a facility that allows us to essentially mimic most climates in our greenhouses. Mm-hmm. Our facility is at 4,280 feet in elevation. It's in the dry, high desert. It is isolated from all other commercial agriculture purposely so that we can create a genetic material or seed that is from pest, pathogen, and virus-free stock. Now, these greenhouses and where they are, they enable us to induce the epigenetic influence or essentially mimic the environmental conditions of almost anywhere. So unlike a lot of the other seed breeders out there, the genetic varieties that we've created across the board, six that have been released so far for the 2020 season, and I believe we'll have two more in May, these are all for specific microclimates and bioregions. So we have the ability in our greenhouses to kind of give you an idea, to recreate a 10% humidity and a 110 degree, you know, Fahrenheit scenario, mm-hmm. which would be similar to a really desert climate, or we can do, you know, 45 degrees in a sustained 100% humidity, which would be more like, you know, more like a coastal environment where we're testing for mold, mildew. And the plant is a very quick learning plant. So over just a few generations, the plant, you know, sort of adjusts or adapts to these influence. And, you know, we've verified that now through university research and some of the studies we've seen, particularly on mildew and the plants that we expose to high humidity.
Now, one of the biggest decisions that farmers face, just one of the many, many decisions they face when getting involved in hemp, is to choose whether they're going to plant seeds or use clones. You guys work very closely with this. What's the difference between the two?
Certainly. So, you know, we have a deep experience with both avenues. So we've created a lot of clones and put a lot of clonal varieties out in the field. We've created a lot of seed. And essentially, to me, it comes down to a couple of factors, but primarily scale. When you scale to a certain size, the benefit of seed, you know, becomes very strong. You know, when you're talking about a clone, the great benefit of a clone is that you're going to have an identical plant. And when we're talking about hemp genetics specifically, we're not to a 7th or 11th generation, which is where these plants become stable to the point where, just like a corn plant, you're looking at, the parent passing on 9 out of 10 dominant traits or alleles to offspring. So you can see that uniformity across the field. We're really early on in the breeding programs. There are some groups out there that are pushing out F2s and F3s, but there's really in the gene pool, when you look at the Punnett square, there's a lot of instability in those genetics. So being in these F1 varieties, one of the great benefits of doing a clone is that now you can create that uniformity from a mother plant across the field. The downside of that is that the cost of clones, when it comes down to the infrastructure, the time and labor involved, once you reach a scale of, say, 10 acres, you know, or 20,000 plants or more, that becomes a little bit cost prohibitive and a little bit labor intensive. So there's one of the primary reasons that you would look at seed over clone. The second is seed vigor, something called seed vigor. So when we talk about a seed comes out with a little bit more strength and stamina generally than a clone of variety will. And a seed is going to push down a taproot directly into the soil. So therein, a seed is going to get a better start. A seedling will get a better start generally than a clone. And as long as you have if you're doing a decent scale, and as long as you have a good seed producer that understands their variety and essentially can limit the phenotypic variants or expressions that you see in the field, the different expressions, then I think a seed is generally going to outweigh a clone in most situations.
Explain the difference in expressions and what you mean by that, if you can expand on that.
Okay, so when we take an F1 variety or filial one, which is essentially a first generation, which it's kind of funny, but in the genetics world, these filial ones tend to be much more stable than a 2 or a 3 or a 4, just the way that the nature of the Punnett square and the recessive traits that you pull up. Now, filial one, though, will still have some different expressions in the field. So what you're looking for, you know, on a small scale, you want to see no more than maybe 3 or 4 of these variations. And what I mean by these variations is they're not generally variations in cannabinoid content, mm-hmm. but they're variations in the visual expressions of the plant or the smell of the plant. So you'll see slightly different terpene profiles or slightly different color profiles. Some you may see a little shorter plant or a little taller plant. There's a little longer internodal spacing or a little shorter internodal spacing. So that's the type of phenotypic variability or variance that we're talking about in a variety.
I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Sounds like they may be less expensive to go with the seeds instead of the clones.
You bet. The seeds are going to be an easier, safer variety, especially if you have a limited experience with the hemp plant or the cannabis plant or taking clones or creating rootstock. It's a little bit more of a difficult process than germinating a seed. And I would say at this point, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the genetics just weren't quite developed for the CBD industry on the hemp side. However, we're coming into a time where there are some great companies out there. There are at least a half a dozen companies out there that are creating pretty stable, high quality, good feminized genetics that puts you in the position where a seed is pretty much always going to outweigh a clone these days.
Between the seeds and the clones, is there any difference between how many males, how many females you would get? And go into that a little bit about the quality genetics of the plants.
You bet. And forgive me for not addressing that right away, but that is another great reason to go with a clonal variety if you're not sure about your seed. Is obviously, the clonal variety has been proven female. Ideally, it's been proven stable because the plant being male and female, there's hermaphroditic potential or potential for it to actually throw male traits out of a female plant. So if you have a stabilized clone, now you know that you have a guaranteed female out of every plant. However, we've evolved the feminization technology to the point where what we're seeing in the field is consistently on the low side, 1 in 9,000 males, and on the high side, 1 in 5,000 males. Essentially, not enough that you will have to spend any energy going out and roguing or finding males, or worry about your crop being pollinated or any of your neighbor's crops being pollinated.
All right. And another topic, I guess, that goes right into that would be currently right now we're dealing with the Indiana, for instance, is a total THC state. We're looking at federal compliance, the total THC levels. I know you guys are working on that. Can you get into that a little bit?
So, you know, we've sort of developed a set of programs under pilots in these states, which were running under just one variant of the THC, which is the Delta 9 THC. And essentially, if you're looking at Delta 9, you're only looking at, like I said, you're not looking at the THCA. So you're only looking at one piece of the total THC component. And I think a lot of why these programs developed this way in these states, these pilot programs, is one, the genetics just weren't refined enough. They weren't mature enough. They were still in their infancy. And so we were still trying to find genetic that could comply to the federal standard. Now, we knew the federal standard on the 2014 Farm Bill, and it was reiterated again in the 2018 Farm Bill, was going to be total THC compliance. However, trying to give the farmers a tool, trying to get the industry a leg up, I think a lot of the genetics that were developed, we're struggling to find that. And therefore, we appealed to departments of ag in certain circumstances, I believe, to have them help us by just looking at this one variant of THC. That's unfortunately ending. So a lot of states last year were able to grow Delta 9. We did see, unfortunately, a lot of farmers get caught out with Delta 9 genetics, not understanding that they were operating under a total THC program. We saw a lot of crops embargoed. And so I'm really grateful, actually, to the USDA for coming up and clarifying this and setting it in stone that the standard is going to be 0.3 total THC.
I know one of the issues could be how much of the plant they're actually testing. I know that's a problem from state to state. How do you see that? And is there a difference in how much of the plant is tested?
Well, of course, anytime that you're going to take a broader piece of the plant, the flower itself is what contains, most of the resin. So anytime you're going to include stalk or water leaf, now you're going to lower the resin content. So that makes those tests easier to pass. Same thing with extending the pre-harvest test window from the time of harvest. However, I think we just had a very interesting article come out from Cornell that kind of backs up what we've been learning over the last several years here. And that's that if you have the right genetics, if you have the right genetic sequence and the right genetic picture, then it doesn't matter what piece of the plant, it doesn't matter what time you test it. It really just comes down to how the breeder is working to fit into the program and be compliant with the program.
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up for us, or at least giving us some insight on that. And again, we're speaking with Jeremy Kletke, the CEO and founder of Davis Hemp Farms in Bend, Oregon. Jeremy, when farmers come to you and they ask about, especially new farmers, or not new farmers, but people new to hemp, and they ask, how many plants should I plant? They're going to ask you about seeds versus clones, but how many acres should I start with? What do you tell those folks, and how do you get them started?
Well, every case is going to be individual, Jason. So, we look at a farmer, we look at their experience, the type of field acres they've been doing, the quality of land that they have, how developed that land is, what's been grown in the past, has it lie fallow. So there are a ton of variables that would lead me to help a farmer to determine what size of parcel they should be growing. So again, we're going to take that on an individual basis. I will take a step back in the conversation, though, and elaborate on something that I think is going to be critical for Indiana farmers. Mm-hmm. and is going to be critical for, most of the farmers in the Midwest as they're coming into this program, is what you just touched on, which is the Delta 9 to total THC. This is in the genetic code. It's going to be really important this year for farmers to know that the genetics they have will pass that federal compliance. We're seeing a lot of genetics slide under the radar that we're concerned are going to be hot as they come out into the market, and they're being sold as genetics that potentially are federally compliant. So I would just, warn a farmer, make sure that whoever they're looking at for their seed source, understand that the plant is one dioecious, so the feminization rates are going to be critical and should be third party verified. These seed providers should also have good good germination rates from, you know, ideally a university seed lab, but certainly third party. And they should have a COA that will show a certificate of analysis from an accredited laboratory that will show that at harvest, these plants will pass that federal compliance test. And on what you said, which is, a 6-inch terminal cola. So just the top 6 inches of the flower, what these people are using to test is important. And I would also encourage the farmers to never hesitate to call the laboratories and call the third party testing facilities that the seed provider is using and ask them about these people's reputation. Most of the good seed providers have built rapport and have been in the industry for several years, and the third party people that they're working with, the testing facilities, know them and will stand behind them. So that was just something I want to clarify before we move on to the next thing.
And I appreciate you clearing that up, because that is a great question. If I am purchasing, how would I know who to go to, who that third party is? There's going to be a lot of bad players out there. How do I know which third party to go to? Is that something they should be providing me?
Okay, yeah. So there are going to be, you know, obviously reputable third-party testing facilities and some that aren't. And I would just look for accreditation, you know, in any lab. So I'll give you an example for Oregon. So here we are as a seed producer in Oregon. We're using the Oregon State University Seed Lab to provide our germination rates as well as our purity rates, so that any state that we're working with knows that we're not going to impact them with noxious weeds or any kind of foreign seed. The laboratories that we're using for our certificates of analysis are ORLAP accredited, which is basically the Oregon standard for laboratory accreditation. And I believe that every state, including Indiana, is going to have some sort of accreditation program. So mm-hmm. If you're seed producers in Indiana, make sure you're, you know, seeing that they are running through a lab that's accredited. I think the main thing that we're seeing, and I don't want to get to the darker side of the industry, but I think the main thing we're seeing are just falsified documents. So if you are, you know, take the time to call the laboratories and just verify that those documents belong to that company, that they are real and valid, and certainly ask your seed provider when and how they did their sampling. It's very important.
All right. Once again, speaking with Jeremy Kletke, CEO and founder of Davis Hemp Farms in Bend, Oregon. And again, Jeremy, I really appreciate all the information you're giving us here today. And a couple more questions for you here. Of course, looking from the difference between the Midwest and the West Coast out there, obviously weather's different, terrain is different, geography is different. But one of the things that would be the same, things like pest control, drifting, do we see the same thing regardless of where you're at?
You know, every bioregion and microclimate is going to have its own specific set of pests, pathogens, depending on what's been grown there. You're going to have your own, you know, independent issues. The beautiful thing about hemp is it's a diverse plant. It's been grown all over the world, and it is a relatively pest-resistant plant. It creates volatile organic compounds in overunity, and these volatile organic compounds that we call terpenes, they are designed not only as communication tools to the other plants in the field, but as communication tools to the pests in their environment. So the plant has a tendency to be able to fight off most pests in most regions. And this is something, as a breeder, you look to develop plants that are going to be capable of putting on terpenes early to be able to fight pests and be able to be pest resistant. As far as, you know, working in the climates, you know, that goes back to, again, your seed provider. You want to make sure that they understand the difference in the genetic lines that they're putting out as far as how they respond in different regions. I think that's one of the things that is greatly overlooked in this mad race that we have to just put seed on the market in this new industry, is the idea that, you know, not all seed is created equal, and not all seed or all plants come from the same regions or are historically developed for the same sort of climate.
And regardless of where the farmers are in the United States, they can purchase seed from you, correct?
That is correct.
And how do they get a hold of you, and what can they do to make that happen?
So you can look us up, contact at davishempfarms.com. and we will be happy to respond to you immediately. Any inquiry that you have, go ahead and put it up there, and we would be, you know, more than happy to answer questions, just as we are on the podcast. Sometimes these things raise more questions than they answer, so we'll be happy to be there. I think that's a lot of what we do, is help to educate, help to support farmers. It's one of the things that I think that separates us from the other seed companies, is that we understand it's an industry in its infancy, and that farmers' success is our success, a farmer's failure is our failure. So a seed sale is not the end of it for us. It's sort of the beginning.
Certainly. And again, we know you're a world traveler there, Jeremy, but will we see you in the Midwest anytime soon?
Yes, we are planning to spend some time in Indiana. I was supposed to be making a presence at iHemp, and unfortunately wasn't able to make it in Michigan. But we hope to be attending events as the season progresses. And certainly if anybody out there sees an event, or if there are any farming events or farm bureaus that would like to, you know, have us be engaged, or have me come out and you know, offer some insight, please don't hesitate to reach out again. It's, you know, contact@davishempfarms.com.
All right, Jeremy, anything else we need to hit on before we let you go today?
Yeah, you know, I think we've really touched on a lot. I'm hopeful that we've given the farmers the tools they need. Just to kind of recap, we know the plant's dioecious, so be aware of the cheap seed. You know, the cheap seed is generally the non-feminized seed. It's quite a process to go through to create feminized seed. It's a little different than any other seed industry out there. So, you know, be aware of the cheap seed. Watch out for who your seed producers are. You know, something maybe we didn't touch on is, you know, make sure that your seed breeders are pest, pathogen, and virus free. If they aren't, sometimes, you know, certain things such as verticillin and wilt could embed itself in the genetic code, I believe, of the seed, certainly the predisposition for viruses. And so you don't want to be bringing those things into your environment at all. So be aware of, you know, how your seed producers are producing seed, and check. I think we talked, check their feminization rates for third party, their germination rates are third party. And that they're, you know, at any time you can, that they're on your state list. Most of the states now are coming out with a nice approved list. We've certainly been proactive to communicate with all the departments of ag and wherever possible beyond those state lists. So check those lists, and don't hesitate to reach out to the Department of Ag in your state and ask them, you know, who they feel would be a good seed provider. But at the end of the day, you know, my biggest advice to you is, you know, if you don't start with the right genetics, you set yourself up for failure.
Certainly some great information there. Once again, Jeremy Kletke, the CEO and founder of Davis Hemp Farms. And you can get more information by contacting him at Davis Hemp Farms, again, in Bend, Oregon. Jeremy, thanks so much. We do appreciate your time. Certainly look forward to meeting you when you do get to the Midwest. And we look forward to having you back on the podcast sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I'd love to be back anytime. I appreciate you having me, and wish all the farmers in Indiana luck this year.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. And that will do it for our show this week. Thanks for listening to the Midwest Hemp Council Weekly Podcast, brought to you by the Bose Public Affairs Group at Bose, McKinney & Evans. You can find more information about the Midwest Hemp Council on our website at MidwestHempCouncil.com. I'm your host, Jason Dozier. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more. So long, everybody.